So Revelation chapter 9, it's full of frightening images of what will one day, perhaps soon, happen on earth. By the time we get to Revelation 9, John has already described some fairly frightening things that Jesus showed him are going to happen. Four of the seven angels who've been given trumpets to blow, they've now blown their trumpets by the time we get to chapter 9. And though each trumpet blast has followed the one before it without interruption, except for the description of things that were happening on earth after those were done, there's an unexpected pause in the action between the fourth angel's trumpet and the fifth angel's trumpet. Suddenly, John sees an eagle appear directly over his head. And it speaks. Odd vision. And a speaking eagle, not a parrot, but an eagle speaking, delivering an announcement regarding what will follow the blast of the last three trumpets still to come. Now, this announcement is an important link between what preceded it and what follows. It introduced what happens in chapters 9 and following, but it sets the last three events apart from the first four as something much more intense. Chapter 8, verse 13, then, is a fitting close to the message from chapter 8 and a fitting introduction to chapter 9. And so we're going to start with the last verse of chapter 8 this morning. John writes, "Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blast of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow." Does he have your attention? This is what this is here for. It's to get our attention. Something dramatic is about to happen. What you've seen before was bad, but what's going to come is worse. Indeed, those last three trumpets are going to bring serious woes on the earth that will make everything before this look like child's play. John sees the first woe. Follow along with me as I read about this in its entirety. We're going to read all of chapters 9, verses 1 through 12. It's not all of 9, but those all of the vision here about the fifth angel. And then we'll go back through it. We're going to find the structure and dig into the meat of the passage. Revelation 9, starting at verse 1. "And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fall from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green plant, or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces, their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails and stings like scorpions, and their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. They have as a king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek is Apollyon. The first woe is past. Behold, two woes are still to come." That's quite a description, isn't it? Can you picture that? It's hard to picture that, because we really don't have anything to which to compare it. I can imagine John, as he's writing this, how difficult it must have been to describe these things. Thankfully, the Holy Spirit guided him as he wrote. Nonetheless, this is an awesome, frightening, terrifying picture that John paints. What are we to make of this? Now, whereas last Sunday, in the same number of verses, we read about what happened following the blast of four trumpets, John provides much more detail of a much more serious plague, if you will, following the blast of this trumpet. Now, I use the word plague here, even though it's not found anywhere in the text. I've already noted in earlier descriptions the parallels to certain aspects of the plagues God sent on Egypt as recorded in Exodus. God used plagues in that time for two main reasons, and he described it in Exodus chapter 6. For one thing, God was punishing Egypt for their treatment of his people, and he was using those plagues to deliver his people from their oppression and from their oppressors. But the bigger purpose of the plagues that God sent on Egypt was repeated over and over throughout Exodus, that the Egyptians would know God and know that he is the one true God. The Egyptians rejected the Israelite God, but God was going to show them, and he used the plague to do it. It's the major purpose of these plague-like judgments we find here in Revelation that will befall the earth at the end of time. That the world will see that God is the one true God. There's also a parallel to the plagues in Egypt. Inasmuch as God will, with these things, deliver his people, the church, from oppression and will punish our oppressors. Thus, I think it's safe to conclude that Christians will not be subject to the effects of these judgments meant for unbelievers who have rejected God as the Egyptians. In spite of all they will have seen, they're still going to reject God. So with those things said, let's take a look at the fifth angel and the first woe. The action begins with the angel, like the four before him, doing his job, taking that shofar trumpet, that ram's horn trumpet, and blowing it. And as before, this looks like the extent to which his role on the scene goes. That's all these angels are doing, is they're blowing their trumpets. And then after that, something happens on earth. We saw it with the first four. And in response to this angel's trumpet, a star falls from heaven to the earth. Now, John had seen this before, with the breaking of the sixth seal on the scroll, when a third of the stars fell from heaven. However, it's not until this point that it's described in such a way as to cause us to wonder what he meant by a falling star. We're going to come back to that in a minute, but kind of keep that question in your mind. This star falling from heaven. The next thing John reports is there's a key to the bottomless pit, or the abyss, that's released. Let's read that again in verse 1 and 2. The fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Now, there's three things that I really want us to consider here. First of all, who received the key? Who gave the key? And what in the world is this bottomless pit? We'll start with who received the key. On first reading, when I first read this, I was kind of going from the assumption that it was the angel who blew his trumpet. The grammar is ambiguous. We must depend on our knowledge of how the other angels behaved after they blew their trumpets. Their role in every case was strictly to blow the trumpet, to blow the horn. And it would be strange for one of the angels, whose job it is to blow the horn of command, to then set his horn down and go take part in the action. That he would be the only one to do this would be very strange. And so, who is the he who is given the key to the bottomless pit? I think John assumes that it's clear because he doesn't give an explanation. Now, if we discount the angel who has the horn, if we say that wouldn't fit, because none of the other angels have done this, then we're left wondering who has entered the scene. Someone has entered the scene. Because the only one we have here right now is this angel. The only one that John puts in this scene is this angel who's blowing the fifth trumpet. So who has entered? Let me ask it another way. What has entered? Catch that? A star has just fallen from heaven to earth. Read the sentence again, starting with that part of it. I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key. Now wait a minute. Is the star the one who's given the key? Now, if we read this as a literal star, a flaming ball of gas, which is what stars are, then we're going to have some problems with that interpretation. The star must represent a person. But who? Now, maybe you bear in mind the images of Satan being cast to earth from heaven when he rebelled against God. It's one of the first things that came to my mind, as in picturing Satan being cast out of heaven. Even in Job 38:7, Job connects stars with the sons of God, which is a term for angelic beings. And then in Revelation, John had said that the stars that Jesus held in his hand, the seven stars, they represented the angels of the churches. Now, I'm a little hesitant to use that verse to say that angels equals this an angel is this star, because we know that John, and here John is referring to, Jesus is referring to the lead pastors or elders of those churches, because that's who he addresses in each one of those. But nonetheless, I think there is clear evidence here to conclude that this star represents an angel of some sort. And so it seems appropriate, it seems the right biblical interpretation here, that this image of this star is actually an angel. Now the next question becomes, who is this angel? Undoubtedly that question kind of hangs in the air, who is this angel? But I don't want to spend a lot of time conjecturing on that, because John simply doesn't say. And so I think we can say it really doesn't matter who this angel was, because John didn't even call him an angel, he called him a star. He saw a star and represents an angel, and we're not told who this angel is. So let's not get too distracted by that. Whoever he is, he receives a key. Which raises the next question. We can talk about what the key is, but we're not going to worry about that. My question is, who gave this key? Because John doesn't mention anyone having given this key. Now, it's odd that no one is credited with doing this, because it drives the action of the story, this key being given. However, it's a literary tool that John has used before. He's noted before an unidentified voice giving direction. And the unstated implication is that God gave the key, just as God was the unstated voice in these other visions. God is going to be in complete control of what is about to transpire. And so by handing off this key, God authorizes the release of this terrible fate on earth. The key symbolizes the imprisonment of those who are about to be released. And so the next question to ask is, what in the world is this bottomless pit? Now, this is the first we hear of a bottomless pit here in Revelation. But to what does it refer? Now, we can infer some from the context here in Revelation, but the term will come up again. And so we need to understand it. Most translations, even modern and old alike, translated it bottomless pit. But it's actually from the Greek word abyssos, which is transliterated abyss. We find this word used most in Revelation. 7 out of the 9 times this word is used in the New Testament, it's in Revelation. And every time, it's in this kind of a context. Observe, 9:1, which we just read, 9:1 and 2. The fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fall from heaven, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace. A little later in the same chapter, verse 11, they, these locusts, have a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit. And then in chapter 11, verse 7, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that rises from the bottomless pit will make war on them and conquer them. In chapter 17 and verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. So there's the beast from the bottomless pit. And then in chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain, and he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit, there's that word, and shut it and sealed it over him. And so we see that it's the same bottomless pit time and time again. It's kind of used in the same context as a prison. But one of the other two places in the New Testament that it's used is very helpful in understanding to what this refers. And it's Luke 8:31, so I'll put on the screen here in a minute. Jesus encountered in that passage a demon-possessed man who had been living among the tombs. And having commanded the demon to come out of that man, you're probably familiar with that story, the demon pleaded with Jesus. He said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." And then verse 29 says, "For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man." So here's this man. He's pleading with Jesus, these demons. "Don't torment me." And then Jesus asked for the demon's name, to which he responded. Anyone know this story? Anyone can tell me the name of the demon?
Legion.
Legion. Because there was many, right? You all are familiar with this story. Jesus then, he commands this demon to come out, but the fear of this demon is that he not be sent to the abyss. "Don't command me to depart to the abyss." It's the very same word. And so from this brief encounter, we learn much about this so-called abyss. The demons speaking to Jesus in this account did not want him to torment them or send them to the abyss. They understood the abyss to be a place of torment for them. Now this should not be confused with hell, lake of fire. From the places we've seen this word used, we can safely conclude that it will be a holding cell for fallen angels, demons, the beasts, and the false prophet and Satan. The demon named Legion viewed it as a place of torment, but it's not the final place. We'll learn more about that in the weeks to come. This abyss is the place that God holds certain evil spiritual beings to await later punishment. And so we may thus be surprised when this fallen star is allowed to open the abyss, the bottomless pit. Now, John observes here that God will authorize the release of those beings to allow them to torment people who've served them for so long. It's sadly ironic. People who have knowingly or unknowingly served these demons for so long will now be tormented by these very same demons with the opening of the bottomless pit. And so begins the action on earth. Let's read this again, the second part of verse 2. "And from the shaft rose smoke, like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green plant, or any tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them." And so the first thing John sees is this smoke coming from the shaft, which is the entrance to the abyss. It's an ominous sign, this dark, thick, black smoke rising from a hole in the earth. Now that's only slightly frightening, because then from this smoke, these strange creatures begin to pour forth. John describes them initially as locusts from the smoke. Now perhaps from his initial perspective, that was their initial appearance. But he'll describe them more in more detail later, and we'll see that they were in fact much more terrifying than small bugs. Immediately though, John notes some things about these locust-like creatures that indicate they're going to have they're going to be much more than locusts. Now first of all, he says they have the power of scorpions. Imagine an invasion of locusts that were poisonous. Anyone been around? Has anyone seen an invasion of locusts firsthand? Have you seen it on TV? Frightening when you see the invasion of locusts. Now, imagine that same invasion having the ability to sting like a scorpion. That's frightening. People that don't like bugs would be freaked out just by the locusts. But then you find out that their fears are actually well-founded, because these locusts are like scorpions, makes it even worse. And so as the smoke ascends to the heavens out of this pit and it darkens the skies, these locust-like creatures begin to pour out of the smoke. Oh my goodness, what is this? Another confirmation of the fact that these are not just locusts is that they're given instructions. Locusts don't take instructions, in case you didn't know that. They come as an invading horde, devouring everything in their path, and then moving on. But these creatures are in fact told specifically not to harm the vegetation, which is the biggest clue that they're not regular locusts. Because this event will be exclusive of the plants. You may recall that earlier a third of the plants had been destroyed. But these locusts, leaving the vegetation alone, indicates that they are definitely not your typical locusts. Because typical locusts strip every green thing when they swarm in this fashion. These special locusts will only come after human beings. Of course, by the time this plague breaks loose, a fourth of the Earth's human population will have already been killed by the fighting, the famine, the diseases, and all those things that follow the fourth seal. And so these locusts are going to be instructed to inflict torment on every human except those who have the seal of God on them. Now, who are these folks who have the seal of God, who are protected from this plague? Are these Christians? Now, we've not heard anything about believers or the church in any of this to this point, which leads many to conclude that the church has been removed by this point. But to be clear, there's no explicit mention of that anywhere in this text in Revelation. Now, John had already seen that there were saints under the altar who had been coming out of the tribulation. And they were told to wait because there were still more Christians who would be slain for their testimony. And so some saints will have been in the tribulation and killed for their faith. But we assume that if there are saints still on the earth during these plague-like things, they will be protected from them, as the Israelites were protected from the plagues that befell Egypt. And here is the explicit indication of that. Of that protection on those who have the seal of God. But still, the only ones that John has noted as having been sealed was after the breaking of the sixth seal, when he saw 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel who received the seal of God on their foreheads. So unless others have been sealed that I've missed or that aren't mentioned here, which I won't deny that possibility, that leaves the vast majority of the human population facing this torment. Now, the focus here is not on those who were sealed, but the focus is on who wasn't sealed. It's on the torment of those who are not sealed, which is most of the earth's population. Torment is described in two ways. First of all, these locusts will be given a full 5 months to torment. They will not be allowed to kill anybody. Now, this is true of most natural scorpions. They generally only make a person very, very sick and cause a myriad of symptoms that may make the person wish that they could die. The symptoms are also usually only last about 5 months. But more importantly, 5 months is the normal lifespan of a scorpion. But whatever the case, for 5 months the people on earth will be in torment, but without death, which of course will be worse than death. They'll wish for death, but it will not come. Now think about this. Bring this to, we're thinking someday yonder or someday, we kind of have this picture in our mind and we forget about this the modern day. Okay? So think about right now today, all of the different painkillers and pharmaceutical and homeopathic remedies in the world that exist right now today. Of all of those things, nothing will bring relief to this torment. This will be awful for those who have refused Christ. They'll be left to face these awful creatures and their poison. But it's not just their poison that is terrifying. Their appearance is also terrifying. And as John describes the appearance of these locusts, we suddenly discover that these are not just little grasshoppers. These things are huge. He describes them thus, verse 7. In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces, their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails like scorpions and stings like scorpions, and their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name is in Hebrew Abaddon, and in Greek he's called Apollyon. Now, to the first century reader living to the east of Rome, as John's first readers were, remember the seven churches in Asia Minor, the descriptions of these locusts may well have conjured up images of the feared Parthian warriors living to their east. For those who remember any of the years from between the late 1940s and about 1989, the Parthians would have been like the Russians of the first century. During the Cold War, Americans lived in fear of an invasion by Russia, perhaps into Alaska, which is just a short distance from Russia across the Bering Strait. The ruthless socialist communist government, desperate to fund yet another failed attempt at socialism, invaded countless small nations with eyes for bigger nations in a quest for more resources. The Parthians were quite like that. America stood as the leader among nations to defend the world from the spread of this tyrannical, godless oppression that socialism inevitably brings. But Americans lived in fear, and especially if they lived on the West Coast or worse, in Alaska, being 50 miles from Russia. And so it was for those living in Asia Minor of the Roman Empire. With eyes on Rome as the major threat to their conquests, the Parthians needed to eliminate this threat. And certainly the farther you live from them, the less you might have thought about them. But reading John's description may well have triggered images of the Parthians in the minds of the first readers. Most notably may have been the Parthian warriors' long flowing hair and their horses' tails, which were twisted in the ropes. The iron breastplates of the locusts would have been reminiscent of the steel armor of the Parthian warriors. And these warriors were also known for their poison arrows that they used skillfully. They could shoot them both in attack and in retreat. They could shoot those puppies behind them, those poison arrows, and get even the people that were chasing them down as they retreated But those arrows had poison which had the same effect as a scorpion's poison. Now, not every detail was reflected in the Parthian warriors, and we wouldn't expect that, since these are not actually in view here. Some of you may remember some Christians saw in the Russian armies reflected in the descriptions of these scorpions when Russia was a threat. Now, I've heard these scorpions being attributed to being helicopters. And John was describing the best way he could. You know, the thundering feet, their wings like thundering feet. Oh, that's helicopters. The breath, oh, that's helicopters. All these things. It's an image of a helicopter. Now, it's true that some of these things remind us of helicopters. Perhaps in a way that first century readers in Asia Minor might have thought of the Parthian armies. However, the text is clear that these are beings who are currently locked away that will be temporarily released. These are not any kind of human armies or equipment. Remembering the beginning of the description, as they came pouring forth from the abyss as the smoke comes out, their release will be dramatic, and their appearance will be frightening, and they will cause torment to the humans living on earth who lack the seal of God. These will not be locusts or any other kind of never-before-seen poisonous bug. These are demonic beings who are given the ability to inflict harm on people. But God is still in control, only allowing them this freedom to accomplish his punishment on the rebellious human population at the whim of the very creatures they have followed and mimicked even today. The numbers of these creatures will be impressive, but they will operate in a very orderly fashion as they will be ruled by the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name John gives us. He has Abaddon in Hebrew and Apollyon in Greek. Now, the thing to remember here is that their actions will be under the direction of an intelligent being. And this intelligent being, having been a leader among the demons in the abyss, has a name, meaning destruction. And John gives it again, both in Hebrew and in Greek. This king of the abyss orchestrates destruction by the plague of demon locusts on humanity. And for 5 months, this reign of terror continues. Until finally, the first woe ends. Verse 12, the first woe is past. Behold, two woes are still to come. There is on one hand a sense of relief that these terrible things have come to an end. But on the other hand, there should also be a sense of dread that there are still two more things still to come that are at least that bad, and we assume, without having read ahead, we assume they're going to be worse. Their woes. Now, if you grew up hearing about the 10 plagues, and how God used to punish them, God used them to punish Egypt and to cause Egypt to finally let the Israelites go, you may take those plagues for granted. But they often exist in our mind as some sort of a distant event, both in time and place. Now, we know how God protected his people, the Israelites, during this time, as he unleashed a series of terrible plagues and frightening plagues on the Egyptians, even as the Egyptians continue to refuse to acknowledge God all the way to the end. The parallels between God's use of plagues recorded in Egypt, or in Exodus, on Egypt, and the judgments John saw coming and recorded in Revelation are striking. Perhaps that's why we tend to look at what we've read today as some sort of distant event, both in time and place. And let me assure you, they are not. They will happen in modern times. And it's clear from all that we've read so far in Revelation to this point, they will happen over the entire planet. Not just in the Middle East, not just somewhere else, but yes, indeed, here. This is a worldwide thing that's coming. And so we dare not relegate it to the some other time, some other place portion of our brains. Are you following? When we read Bible stories, especially if you've grown up with them all your life, you have these pictures in your mind, right? You kind of go to another place, another time. And there's a danger in that when we read Revelation. Because it's not another time and another place. It's coming. And it's not coming to some other place. It's coming here. This is real. This is going to happen. It's going to happen here too. It's going to be around the world. And so it will impact those who have refused Jesus. And it should. If you're here this morning and you have refused Jesus, this should scare you. Because you have good reason to be scared, because this is what you face. Don't miss that. This is your destiny without Jesus. It is those who have refused the offer of salvation through faith in Jesus who will undergo the torment of the demonic locust scorpions. That's if they've survived the first judgments. Now, if on the other hand you're like me, and you've embraced that message of salvation through faith in Jesus' sacrificial death on your behalf, you should find great comfort in this account of what is to come. Because at the very least, you should expect protection from these things. Whether that protection is over you as you're on earth, as these things unfold, or whether it is in heaven, there's a very clear indication that believers will not be impacted as the wrath of God falls on the earth. This will impact the unbelievers. And so there's a sense of comfort for us. God will punish those who refuse to acknowledge Him as Lord. And He will protect those who surrender to Him as Lord. So the question to ask is, which one are you? If you've hardened your heart against the gospel for whatever reason, you will face this wrath. It doesn't matter how you justify your rejection, even if it's because you don't see a deep need because you're a pretty good person. If you've never called out to God for forgiveness, trusting solely in what Jesus did on the cross, this awaits you. You should be afraid. You should be very afraid. Now, maybe you consider yourself a Christian, but your life doesn't reflect that. Be careful. Not everyone, Jesus said, who says to Him, "Lord, Lord," will enter His kingdom. Not even those, Jesus said, who have cast out demons, some of those, who have cast out demons in His name. "Depart from me, I never knew you," will be the last words they hear from Jesus as they're sent out of His presence to face their punishment. So if you're not doing so yet, and you're ready to live 100% for Jesus as a child of the King, I want you to come forward this morning. Maybe you need to signify what you've done in your heart by following Jesus in public water baptism. Well, maybe you just need someone to pray for you. Will you come forward this morning as we sing? Why don't you stand and sing, "I Surrender All"?